Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
There's gold fever on the streets of St. Paul.
A billion-dollar con.
We finally hit the big time.
A jackpot.
There was no sign of anything that was amiss.
Everybody wanted to get rich.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's too good to be true. It's too good to be true.
Hi, I'm Jay, a classical musician based in Birmingham in the UK. I play the cello. And in 2021, during the pandemic, I was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. I'd felt for some time that something wasn't quite right, and I struggled to get a diagnosis. But when I finally did, I began to research not just ADHD, but also mental health more generally. I wanted to understand how terms like ADHD had come about, their origins and history. In the process, I came across a book called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM for short.
Have I even played this before? And how long did it take me to realise that I'm in ADHD mode, so, you know, everything is fast?
Written in America and followed worldwide, it's often referred to as the psychiatrist's Bible, and for the past 72 years has been used to define and explain mental disorders. It began with just over 100 diagnoses, and now there are nearly 300. I'm JM, and over the next hour, this is the documentary, Labelling the World, the Power of DSM, from the BBC World Service. You might not have heard of the DSM manual, but its influence on all our lives is huge.
I think DSM is part of our day-to-day work in Hong Kong.
Ever since DSM-3 became so popular from its very first day of publication in 1980, and every subsequent DSM, a massive bestseller, selling many more copies than there were clinicians, so being bought by patients as well. It became a party game, diagnosing yourself, diagnosing other people.
But I think we use the DSM in Singapore as a book to guide the classification of mental health conditions. Sometimes people describe the DSM as the Bible for psychiatrists, right?
The DSM is published by the American Psychiatric Association, known as the APA. First established in 1844, the APA is the main professional organisation of psychiatrists and trainee psychiatrists in the United States, and the largest psychiatric organisation in the world with 38,000 members. The APA publishes various journals and books, but by far the most influential is the DSM. It's available in 19 different languages, and purchasing a copy of the DSM-5 today would set you back up to $170, though there are various versions which will cost you less. The manual started life as a short book, like a pamphlet, in 1952. Now it's a massive tome which anyone would struggle to carry around with them. But what is the DSM for? Well, the original intention was to create a reference point and a common language for psychiatrists.
Really what it is a way for all the physicians to kind of have a way of communicating with each other. So it sort of standardizes things for us, makes things a little easier so that if you go to practitioner 1, 2, 3, 4, wherever you go, they follow the criteria. So it doesn't matter who does the evaluation, the results should be the same. And that's really the goal across the board.
The notion that we needed some sort of classification for mental disorders goes back a long way in medical history, but the relevant history starts in the 19th century in the United States when the superintendents of asylums for people with mental illness realized that they needed some way of recording who their patients were and beginning to assemble information regarding the potential causes of the conditions that their patients manifested. The result was a series of idiosyncratic diagnostic systems that sprang up and that were generally non-systematic and certainly not standardized. And that continues into the 20th century.
Over the course of time, it became very clear that psychiatric diagnosis was very unreliable. The two different people looking at the same patient, two clinicians looking at the very same patient would come up with a different diagnosis, and that meant you had no reliability in terms of what the right treatment was. DSM-3 in 1980 introduced the innovation of providing criteria for each diagnosis so that clinicians working all over the world would be working off the same page. And it did at the time greatly increase the reliability, the agreement amongst different people looking at patients.
The foreword to the manual says it's used by psychiatrists, clinicians and researchers to define and classify mental disorders, which can improve diagnosis, treatment and research. The DSM is followed in America, Canada and Australia. Other countries use a mixture of the DSM and ICD, the World Health Organization's categorization manual, but they're very similar. And it's the DSM which often takes the lead.
Basically, DSM could be viewed as one of the two major descriptive schemes of mental disorder.
Dr. Heidi Lowe is a psychiatrist based in Hong Kong.
So in my day-to-day clinical practice, I would say DSM is my reference too, because it offers a detailed framework which helped me identify the specific symptom clusters associated with each disorder. We use it for medical student education, teaching, and psychiatry trainee training. Both DSM and ICD-10 are used by Hong Kong clinicians and psychiatrists, and it differs a bit. But after all, we still apply our clinical judgment beyond the guidelines in our practice.
Dr. Jared Ng is a psychiatrist who, until recently, headed the Emergency and Crisis Centre at the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore.
We do use the DSM, even though it is a product of the American Psychiatric Association. All the psychiatrists are expected to know the diagnostic criteria for DSM. I think all of us would use the DSM when it comes to classifying a person with a mental health condition. We use it to guide us in coming up with a diagnosis. But having said that, I must say that we also use the ICD in Singapore. The DSM is more clinical. The ICD covers many, many other conditions. Sometimes we still do refer to the ICD for certain conditions may not be so adequately covered in DSM, especially the latest version. For example, autism spectrum disorder is all combined into one single diagnosis in DSM-5, whereas ICD still maintains a very nuanced approach. It's still divided into different types of conditions like autism, Asperger's, pervasive developmental disorder. And sometimes we find that this is a little bit easier for us to explain to parents.
Dr. Sabrina Anjara is a psychologist from Indonesia. She says learning the DSM was an essential part of her training.
Interestingly, all medical students in Indonesia learn about mental health disorders using the ICD-10. But psychology students, clinical psychology students, learn using the DSM. Now, in the public healthcare system, Indonesia came up with a hybrid of the two. They locally adapted the ICD-10 and DSM-4-TR for use in the diagnostics of psychiatric disorders.
But Sabrina says it wasn't until the mid-early 2000s when most Indonesians began looking for help from medical doctors.
It is still, till very recently, a very conservative society where magic and demon possessions are considered to be the main reasons for alterations of a person's character or behavior. And so the go-to person for any symptoms of mental health disorders would be shamans and religious leaders. It is only recently, and I would say after the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004, that Indonesians started going to primary care centers for help with any mental health symptoms. In the early noughties, we only had around 700 to 800 psychiatrists in a country of over 200 million people. And right now we have 270 million people, and that number hasn't increased much. But the number of psychologists have increased quite significantly. We now have around 2,000 psychologists, and there is also an increase in the prevalence of diagnosis. For many individuals who were labeled with being demon-possessed or perhaps not religious enough to the point of having delusions and hallucinations, their actually finding a diagnostic label to be validation of their experience. And perhaps to a certain extent, if it gives them hope that they too can recover like other people with physical health problems. Having a diagnosis can also mean that there will be a treatment plan and a health facility. And that's a far more appealing option to many Indonesians to being shackled in a forest or chained in a windowless room.
DSM is reviewed and updated every decade or so. It began with DSM-1 in the 50s. DSM-2, DSM-3 and DSM-4 followed, and now it's in its fifth volume, DSM-5, which came out in 2013. But there have been some revisions since then to keep it up to date. So, how does the American Psychiatric Association come up with the disorders it lists in the DSM, and where's the science underpinning it? Vesper Moore is a mental health activist based in the States.
Basically, it's a theory or like a proposal of a condition that is brought to a committee when they revise the manual every few years. But when they revise the manual, generally it is a group of psychiatrists who are a selected few on this committee who decide which diagnoses are categorized.
The evidence is reviewed, they bring experts in.
Former DSM-5 Working Party contributor Michael Sharp.
The experts read the evidence, they argue, they communicate, they put their proposals forward to central committees who maybe push it back again and say, no, that overlaps with another thing, think again. And it's quite a big process. Ultimately, it's opinion based on evidence.
So I would say it's a process that relies heavily on scientific data.
Chair of the current DSM steering committee, Paul Applebaum.
But scientific data don't assemble themselves into proposals. And there are inevitably matters of judgment that have to be reached. So, for example, how much data supporting the validity of a proposal constitutes enough data to warrant its adoption? Where should cutoffs be set? Data can certainly help in setting cutoff. Sometimes they can be something close to definitive, but the application of human judgment is inevitable in addressing many of the questions related to the formulation of diagnostic categories.
There are advantages, of course, because it caused some sort of order into a previously quite chaotic state of affairs where everyone had their own definitions and so on.
Psychiatrist Mats Alder in Stockholm says a diagnosis in the DSM is defined as a collection of symptoms that tend to occur together, but that despite extensive research, the underlying mechanisms, the causes, of most conditions have never been identified.
These are not diseases in that sense that we can verify them. They're sort of statistically clustered definitions, so they're more of like probability diagnosis, and therefore they're called disorders. They are not diseases in the meaning that they are based on a specific test connected to a specific cause. They are clusters of symptoms with a lower degree of what we call validity. They are not worthless, I'm not saying that, but they don't have the same degree of certainty and base.
Many diagnoses in medicine, physical health if you like, are based on tests. There's a lot that aren't. And there's a lot that are based on the same criteria, for example, migraine, irritable bowel, chronic pain. These are developed just the same way that the DSM are. So if you step back from the physical mental and just talk about human illnesses, there's only a proportion, possibly a minority of illnesses where there is a test.
The brain is, of course, involved, but it's too complicated. We don't can verify it by biological or specific biological tests. There are numerous findings connected to the disorders, especially the severe one like schizophrenia. You can't use a specific test. We don't know enough about it. And perhaps just that the brain and the psychology of people is too complicated. So we have not reached that level, perhaps. Or perhaps we will never reach that level. And we have to settle with this helpful, if you use it right, this helpful classification, but if you think too much of it, then it can be also a drawback.
And it would be nice if we had something better, and maybe we will, but that's our best shot at the moment. And I understand people having reservations about that, but if you don't have that, I would say to them, well, what's your alternative? Do we just wait and hope that some, you know, we'll find some biomarkers for all these things, or do we just call it all mental health problems? Or so it's imperfect and it can be misused, but used properly, it's a useful tool, even though it's made ultimately by committees reviewing evidence and using opinion.
In the manual, it clearly states psychiatrists should use discretion in diagnosing. Swedish psychiatrist Mats Alder explains.
I'm a teacher at Karolinska for medical students, and they always, as soon as you ask a diagnostic question, they will look into this little Bible and as if it were the only truth. You try to convey a broader picture, but it's also very sort of simple. You can count the criteria, it's simplified, which is good in one way and bad in another way. And it actually says in the foreword that it shouldn't be the Bible. It should be a part of the investigation. It's not the diagnosis. It's helpful for diagnosis. And if you interpret it this way, then it's a good thing. If you think it's the final word, if you fulfill the criteria, you have the disorder. If you don't, because it's also limited. It's only those symptoms and signs that were included by these committees that are used. But there are lots of other information that are important. So it should just be a part of a clinical assessment. You should read the foreword. It's actually good. So moderate confidence. Use it in the right way. Don't think it's the Bible.
The DSM hasn't been without controversy. In the 1970s, the gay community in the United States clashed directly with the American Psychiatric Association over its inclusion of homosexuality as a mental disorder in the manual.
Many gay and bisexual men would spend thousands of dollars a year on therapies and treatments aimed at turning them heterosexual.
The most harmful was something called diversion therapy, where people, a man would be shown pictures of naked men, and if he responded erotically, would get a shock.
The theory was that by linking desire with pain, they could cure them of their attraction to other men.
One activist leading the campaign for change was the late Charles Silverstein. Charles spoke to the World Service Witness History Programme in 2013.
We were never violent, but we would interfere, do things like block entrances. At one meeting I was at of a psychiatrist in New York, people lie down on the floor in the lobby of the building and cover the lobby completely so that the psychiatrist coming in would have to step on people.
The history of psychiatric diagnosis has lots to be proud of and lots to be ashamed of. And one of the things to be really ashamed of is that homosexuality was included as a psychiatric disorder.
Psychiatrist Professor Alan Francis.
Homosexuality had once been considered a sin in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It switched in many people's minds to being a psychiatric or mental disorder. That was just simply wrong, just clearly wrong. And it took psychiatry almost a century to catch up with this error.
Current chair of the DSM steering committee for the American Psychiatric Association, Paul Applebaum, says it was a very different time.
I would say that the DSM-1, the DSM-2 heavily reflected pre-existing conceptualizations in psychiatry that went back, in some cases, centuries. A decision was made to remove homosexuality as a disorder, recognizing that it reflected longstanding cultural biases for it to have been categorized in that way in the first place. The process has become much more data-oriented since that point in time. One can't exclude cultural influences in any project that is undertaken by human beings or probably by artificial intelligence these days either. But a strong effort since that time has been made to focus on the data.
So how much should psychiatrists be letting political, moral and social attitudes or media or public pressure and prejudices of the day influence the kinds of diagnostic labels they come up with?
Psychiatrists are human beings, just like everybody else, and they come with opinions, and those opinions are inevitably influenced by the societies in which they live. I think there's no way of getting around that. On the other hand, their opinions and the cultural influences should not be all that determines the nature of psychiatric diagnosis, or even the primary factor, which is where the heavy evidentiary requirements come in. So can we insulate ourselves from the world around us? No. But to the extent that we have data to rely on, we will make better decisions, and changes these days are heavily dependent on those data.
Psychiatric diagnoses, whether they exist and what form they take, is shaped by sociocultural factors.
DSM-5 contributor, Professor Michael Sharp again.
That's unavoidable because they refer to people's functioning and behavior. And you can't, and indeed argue, you wouldn't want to separate that from human interaction and human societal life. It's part of the thing that psychiatrists have to deal with. We're not dealing with cells in a test tube. We're dealing with thinking, acting, interacting beings. And it is a complication that that's there. I think it's inescapable. I think if you were to find biomarkers for a whole bunch of these diagnoses, you'd still be left with a lot of stuff that you won't, that is going to sometimes be seen as a disorder and sometimes not. Social factors do influence medicine. It's wrong to think that medicine can exist outside them. The main thing is, I think, is that we accept that and we correct it as we go along, as perhaps slowly and perhaps clunkily, I think DSM has done to a degree.
There is no clear, bright line separating normality from mental disorder. It's a very fuzzy boundary. And it's a fuzzy boundary that's tremendously influenced by culture and by the prejudices and the science of the times. And as we move forward, we hope that there's less and less bias in the system, less and less stigma applied to people we don't like, and more science making sure that the diagnostic system is more helpful than harmful. But we still have many diagnoses in the system that are carelessly delivered. We have many people who would be better considered normal, labeled as having mental disorder. They develop stigma, and even worse these days, they're very often given medication that may be more harmful than helpful to them.
You're listening to the documentary Labeling the World, The Power of DSM from the BBC World Service.
Everyone's talking about Briex, a small Calgary mining company that struck gold half a world away.
They sold a $6 billion gold discovery to the world.
They kept drilling, they kept getting good results.
Briex had found the one we all hoped to find.
Investors jumped at the chance to buy up shares.
Everybody was getting in on it.
Suddenly everybody in town was going to be rich.
But there was a problem. You see, the gold, well, it didn't exist.
There's nothing there.
There's no gold. This is a scam.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1952, there were just over 100 categories of mental disorder in the original DSM, DSM-1, which included manic depression, which would later be renamed bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. Over the years, the number of labels has mushroomed, and now it's approaching almost 300. Psychiatrist Professor Alan Francis was chair of the task force that put together DSM-4 in the late 1980s.
Why did I take on the job of doing DSM-4? Partly because I was a diagnostic skeptic. I was one of the people arguing that we needed much more evidence before making choices. Immediately, I set up a plan that would discourage new diagnoses, and that unless the data jumped up and grabbed you by the throat and said, you have to make this change, we would not make the change. We had suggestions for 94 new diagnoses. We accepted only two, Asperger's and bipolar 2, which was a form of bipolar disorder without big highs. Both of those suggestions were based on very good scientific evidence. Our field tests suggested they were both useful, and they both turned out to be absolute disasters, that we've had this tremendous increase of autistic diagnosis very carelessly done. We've had a tremendous increase in bipolar disorder diagnosis, leading to much too many people getting antipsychotic drugs. So even though we were as cautious as we could possibly be, every change we made led to misuse and epidemics of psychiatric disorder that were stimulated by external forces. I don't regret doing it. What I do regret is not having been even more vocal, as the misuse of the system was obviously leading to overuse and the worried well. And certainly I regret not being more vocal in protecting mental patients from becoming homeless and being jailed.
He's since distanced himself from the DSM, claiming there's too many categories and it's beginning to medicalize normality.
DSM-5 went even further and opened up the field to many new diagnoses, to loosening of thresholds for existing diagnoses, to the overuse of the diagnostic system and the overuse of medications.
I think it's really interesting point that it often comes up whether DSM might push us to label what's actually normal human behavior as a medical condition.
Dr. Heidi Low in Hong Kong.
There is this worry. We are turning everyday emotions and actions into something that needs medication. And I think it's not just a casual concern. For example, disorders like disruptive mood dysregulation disorder or even adult ADHD could be over-labeling. So these diagnoses may be understood one way in the US, but in another culture, that might be interpreted very differently. I think there is an interesting survey that focuses on what is the risk factor of having ADHD, and it found the younger group in the class are at risk of ADHD. So is ADHD actually a mental disorder, or rather a lack of accommodation to their education needs? And also, I come across a novel, Bewilderment by Richard Powers, which has one of the quotes like, oddly enough, there's no name in the DSM for the compulsion to diagnose people. When I share this quote on my Instagram, it is immediately liked by my psychiatrist peers. So it's a reminder that DSM is a powerful tool, but it's not a whole story.
Evolution built in emotions that are enormously useful in day-to-day survival. It's important that we be able to experience anxiety, otherwise we do stupid things. It's important that we be able to experience sadness, otherwise we won't know what we value. The emotions of everyday life are not a steady stream of happiness. We have to expect that the human condition will include periods of distress and stress. What's happened over the course of the last 50 so years is to label many states that are transient, stress-related, and normal as mild mental disorder. The fuzzy boundary between normal and mental disorder has been shifted.
Yes, I have some sympathy with that view, but it's DSM is a tool.
DSM-5 contributor, Professor Michael Sharp.
But what they're trying to do is to make that tool work for a wider range of circumstances as possible. In my practice, I'd use a small number of those diagnoses, and the fact there are a lot of others doesn't really bother me. As for medicalizing normality, there's a whole philosophical issue here about what is normal and what is not normal.
The question is, at what point do you cross a threshold at which point a diagnostic label should be applied?
DSM Steering Committee Chair Paul Applebaum.
There's always a question as to the point at which a dichotomous determination is made that somebody moves from not having a disorder to having a disorder. I don't think it's an argument that can be had on general terms. I think you have to look at specific diagnostic categories and ask what's the evidence for any particular cutoff. No cutoff is perfect. There are always false positives and there are always false negatives. And the job of people who work on psychiatric nosologies is to try to minimize those while maximizing the utility of a particular diagnostic framework.
More diagnoses doesn't necessarily medicalize normality. Again, it depends how it's applied. I think having so many of you have makes it the thing potentially unwieldy, and I think that's a different problem.
I don't think it's so much any given diagnosis being ridiculous as the use of useful diagnoses in a ridiculous way. The problem is this lack of a clear boundary and the lack of careful use of the system leads to many people who should not be getting a disorder label getting that label. DSM-5 included something called minor cognitive disorder. And now just about everyone I know over the age of 65 thinks they have it. It's taken the normal diminution in cognitive functioning as part of everyday life and turned it into a mental disorder. It's made everyone hypochondriacal. If you can't remember a name or you're having trouble word finding, you immediately think that you're on the road to dementia when you're not. Half the people will never be demented once that starts, and the ones who are will probably have 10 or 15 or 20 years before they need to worry about it.
Alan Francis, other concern is the overuse of pills.
80% of psychiatric meds are prescribed by non-psychiatrists. And for the most part, that's done after a 10 or 15 minute interview. The patients have in the U.S. been very much influenced by advertising and by social media. Psychiatric diagnoses should be written in pencil. They should be very carefully evaluated over the course of time. You should not be jumping to a diagnosis on the first visit. It's always better to underdiagnose than overdiagnose because it's easy to upgrade the diagnosis. It's very hard to get rid of one. And false diagnoses haunt people for life. They're often put on medications they don't need. They have stigma. They may have trouble getting custody of children. All sorts of problems can happen with a false diagnosis. And very often the diagnosis is followed by a prescription of medication because that's the easiest way to get the patient out of the office.
Two psychiatrists with particular experience, Professor Patrick Landman in Paris and Dr. Jared Ng in Singapore.
This is not just about the doctor, but sometimes some patients will prefer medication above all else. They only want to take medication because they feel that it is the only thing that can help them. And they don't want to leave your clinic empty-handed. They actually ask you for medication. What I tell my patients is that medication is always part of the answer, but it's never the answer.
They are very, I would say, disappointed. When you say, no, you are not ADHD. No, you are not belonging to the spectrum of autism disorder. They are very disappointed and they don't come again and they go to another expert to find somebody who will endorse that they are ADHD or they are autistic disorder or something like that.
Prolonged grief disorder, which is the newest of the additions to the DSM, was a condition before it was recognized as a discrete entity that was often lumped with major depression and treated with antidepressants, which research demonstrated were not particularly effective. And with its recognition comes the designation of a psychotherapeutic treatment, and we'll be siphoning people away from antidepressants into this form of therapy. So it is not a one-to-one correlation between new diagnostic categories and the use of new or additional medications. Often it'll go in the other direction.
Prolonged grief is a great example of the DSM system going way far astray. There is no expiration date on grief. There are some people who develop the classic picture of major depressive disorder during grief. And those people should get a diagnosis of major depressive disorder and should be treated for it. But the problem with DSM-5 is it's made prolonged grief itself a mental disorder. This stigmatizes them. It also reduces the dignity of the loss. To say, oh, you have a mental disorder after X number of weeks or months because you're still grieving, is to take away some of the humanity in human relationships. And it's a great overreach. It was completely unnecessary.
The DSM is a manual put together by the American Psychiatric Association, but efforts are made to include contributions from around the world.
It's a heavily American product. The clear majority of participants are from the United States, but there are countries, generally the English-speaking world, often the UK, who've been involved as well.
There's a feeling from some psychiatrists and psychologists that much more should be done to involve voices from other countries.
Although the authors of the DSM have occasionally flirted with anthropologists about what was called culture-specific syndromes, they have never done so in a sort of wholehearted way.
UK-based clinical psychologist Richard Bentall.
There are a number of anthropologists who've been very interested in mental health cross-culturally, and some of them are also psychiatrists, and they have tried to influence the DSM system to try and make it recognize cultural variability, but largely unsuccessfully. To take a particular example, anorexia nervosa, anthropologists would argue, is a cultural specific syndrome, but it doesn't get mentioned as such because it's specific to our culture and we write the DSM.
We certainly recognize that there's a huge cultural bias in DSM where sometimes it can potentially lead to an inappropriate diagnosis or misunderstanding of behaviors in a non-Western population.
Singapore-based psychiatrist Dr. Jared Ng again.
In the Western world, see social anxiety, for example, as fear of being scrutinized, of being judged. But when we look at how some Asian cultures actually look at social anxiety, it's fear of offending others. It is not so egocentric in that sense. I think it's also quite Asian or Eastern Asian to be more reserved, especially when you meet a person for the first time, and something that can be looked at and classified as difficulty in socializing. So when we see patients, we have to take this into account as well. So we don't just apply the DSM blindly to them.
The reality is, I don't think there is much accommodation for the fact that people have their own ways of grieving or ways of responding to life situations. In Sri Lanka, when they had the tsunami and people were not so distressed as they were expected to be, so that it was a question why this happened. Why should they have not responded very tragically to the tsunami? It was a huge thing in 2004. But it so happened that I think because of the war which had preceded the tsunami, people were already used to a lot of stress and they didn't have the amount of post-traumatic stress disorder as was expected by the medical work. You cannot have an overarching view of people and suffering as though one explanatory model is good for the whole world.
Our relationship with labels is complex. It can lead to misunderstanding, misinterpretation, and stigma. However, for some people, it can help to bring comfort. Finally, you've an answer for the way you feel and possibly treatment to make you feel better.
Music has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. I was musical at age 4, started playing the cello at 6 years old, and finally decided to go pro with my cello at 38 years old. During that time, the world was an incredibly confusing place to me. My ADHD diagnosis and label certainly helped me feel more confident about the direction in which I wanted my life to go, including becoming a certified creative life coach with additional support for people with ADHD. In short, having a label of ADHD has indeed been a means of getting the support I need, finding more people I want to connect with, and be able to offer them further support. But I am cautious around the label becoming my entire identity. That is not something that I want. For good or ill, labels are at the heart of DSM, and I've been hearing from a variety of people living with a label in different parts of the world.
I'm Pratiksha Sharma, and I identify as a peer psychotherapist, musicologist. I'm based out of New Delhi in India. I was diagnosed as bipolar and disorder in the year 1992. I was 20 years old. It was a psychotic breakdown. And then I was on antipsychotics, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, been through electroconvulsive therapy, everything. I've done the works, you know. There are two kinds of stigma. One is the stigma which the patient internalizes, where you think that now, oh my God, that you are a mentally ill person. So you don't want to talk about it to anybody. There's a social side of the stigma that if others get to know what happens to you, you already have a preconceived notion about them. They become the label. So that stigma has a very, very dark side to it. They look at them through a lens of prejudice and they doubt their credibility for every single thing because they are not supposed to have that kind of capacity to speak up for themselves.
Well, I'm Vesper Moore. I'm a mental health and disability rights activist in the United States. I think what was particularly harmful was being labeled by the mental health system as non-compliant. Being an autistic person, and particularly an autistic person of color, when you are overstimulated, you can be viewed as violent, angry, and unreasonable. I mean, growing up, I used to go into grocery stores and I would be followed around the store as if I was going to steal something. So I think that racial profiling played a role in it. But I think also for any autistic kid. When you feel so overwhelmed that you start to scream in a space and no one understands why you are screaming, I think that it is very easy for that situation to escalate and for you to potentially be hospitalized. I've met many Black and brown autistic folks who have like tried to describe what's going on to like a police officer or mental health professional, and the situation has escalated so quickly. Some of them, you know, aren't alive today.
My name is Macy Yang, and I am a media rep living in Shanghai. For me, I feel knowing that I have what's called bipolar disorder put things in perspective. On the other hand, I'd rather not to have that tag with me, because I don't like to be defined by anything. I'm more prone to have a mania mood. I would rather to be described that way instead of be tagged by a disorder.
My name is Mariana Stace. I'm from South Africa and was diagnosed with bipolar mood disorder 20 years ago. So as far as being labeled, for me, it was a massive relief. The amount of self-hatred and anger I felt towards myself, understanding that my altered state put me in a position where I was prepared to take risks, has really helped me. Initially with my diagnosis, after my breakdown, if people bumped into me in the street, they actually couldn't get away from me fast enough. There is stigma. There's no doubt that there's stigma.
My name is Samantha Baines. I am an actress and broadcaster, and I live in the UK, and I have a diagnosis of anxiety, and I take medication for that. And I was worried about having anxiety. And also, I had these thoughts of, I don't know if I want to go to the GP because I don't know if I want this to be on my medical record. I remember crying with relief, because someone was telling me that there was something going on with me and it wasn't just something that everyone else experienced that I wasn't able to control personally. I actively am searching and really want an ADHD diagnosis, again, to get that validation. And it was someone I followed on Instagram that got an ADHD diagnosis. And it was like me going, me too, me too, me too, constantly. But since I got that anxiety label, I feel invigorated and empowered because I know what's going on.
My name is Don Biswas. I'm a British Indian stand-up comedian. I'm neurodivergent, so I have mild traits of Asperger's, so I'm on the spectrum, basically. I have dyspraxia and ADHD as well. And I only found out I got diagnosed while watching Mojo's Top 10 Celebrities with ADHD on YouTube. And then I thought, I've got some of those traits. Just a few people have said to me, you can't be dyspraxia, there's nothing wrong with you. I don't see anything. Because people don't know what dyspraxia is. So there was a bit of that barrier of, if anything, a bit of ignorance.
Now that you have these labels in front of you, how do you use them within your comedy?
It's a lot easier to be political when you've got certain disorders. You can take a look at the actual symptoms of these conditions and it's easier to make a joke. People can relate to it more in a certain extent because it's something different to talk about. When I went to university, there was still that taboo about being on the spectrum, but now you can see 100 other comedians who have got ASD or ADHD, and I think it can be nothing but a positive thing because you've got people you can identify with.
In recent years, there's been an explosion in the numbers of people being diagnosed with mental disorders like autism and ADHD.
The biggest patient group, I think, in Stockholm now is ADHD. And of course, they take a lot of resources and should have resources.
Stockholm-based psychiatrist Mats Alder again.
But there's a danger that they will take resources from the most severe problems like schizophrenia, severe bipolar disorder. There are people with severe problems from what you could call ADHD or autism, and they should have help, of course. But if we extend this too much, then it goes into what we call normal psychology, normal everyday problems. Not everyone is always good to be concentrating. We might be a little restless. Sometimes we don't understand other people properly. Where's the line where this should be described as a disorder and get help from the medical system?
Dr. Ada Carnum is a pediatrician working in Texas. She offers autism and ADHD evaluations for children living in Bel Air. She's seen a huge rise in diagnosis and, worryingly, also people trying to self-diagnose and their children online.
I think it's like, you know, the TikTok era. So, you know, parents see something and they say, okay, you know, they pick one criteria or one, you know, child's flapping their hands or something, a certain thing. And they're like, oh, you know, if your child has this, they're on the spectrum. I think it's just lots of information, but lots of misinformation. And that's why when I come on board and I try to talk to the community, it's really to say that, look, if you are actually truly worried, go get it looked into. Because what happens is when they take in all this misinformation, what ends up happening at the end of the day is when you actually go to a credible source, you're like, well, you know, they're telling you what's actually fact, but they've held on to something that was misinformation. And then it's hard for you to convince them otherwise. And I think that's like you're actually doing them a disservice.
It's not just ADHD and autism spectrum disorder, which has seen a rise in inquiries to psychiatrists.
Singapore is known as the OCD capital of the world. And we have got people who, they may not use it on themselves, but they could look at their friends or their family members and say that, I think you have OCD. You are so OCD. Why are you so obsessive, compulsive about things? And again, I think cast mental illness in a bad light. And so I think that is really the problem with over-medicalizing what could be normality.
Greater awareness of certain disorders through the media has often led to people craving a diagnosis, desperate for some acknowledgement and explanation of the way they are feeling.
And if we need evidence that these mental illness symptoms ride on culture, there's so many examples.
Mental health journalist Ethan Watters wrote a book called Crazy Like Us.
And this is the thing that Westerners really have struggled to understand. These things can be culturally shaped and real at the same time. So you have to put the DSM and the power of it in this whole category of how we influence culture at large. And it's not just the DSM, and it's not just the psychiatric industry, and it's not just the drug companies. It's the people that create movies about mental illness and write popular books, and then the journalists like myself who love the next mental illness. We have to sort of put aside this notion that a psychosomatic illness is not real. It can be culturally influenced, psychosomatic, and utterly real to the sufferer. We don't understand that we're part of the way that these symptoms move around culture.
I think this is an interesting sociocultural phenomena, the adoption of illness, and this kind of odd reversal from saying, well, it's terrible and stigmatizing, you know, God, you don't want one of those, to everybody wanting one, as it were. And it is quite a strange business.
DSM-5 contributor, Professor Michael Sharp, again.
Is DSM to blame? Are the media to blame? I think it's a complex series of things going on. I think it's bad diagnosing a lot of the time. I know there are places that you can go and pay money and get a diagnosis of ADHD signed by a doctor. So it's become a kind of consumer product. And we had a discussion, DSM-5, when I was there. This is the book in front of me, says, as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And the question is it a good idea to call all these things mental? We have cancer diagnoses, we have cardiac diagnoses, we call these psychiatric diagnoses and made them more specific rather than have this completely separate world of mental health. It might help push back on that a bit.
Professor Sharp questions use of the word mental, but what about disorder? Should that be dropped?
The translation of it in Swedish sounds really bad. Sometimes we use syndrome in Sweden instead.
I would say that the Indonesian word for mental health disorders does not actually use the word disorders. It's more of disturbance.
Indonesian psychologist Sabrina Anjara.
I think it's a very interesting and nuanced way of describing it because it implies state where somebody is not disturbed, but just at that moment in time, there is a disturbance. And I think it gives hope that the disturbance could go away, that it's temporary, that this is not what the person is expected to be like.
Whatever the rights and wrongs of the DSM approach, how many of you listening to this program knew about the origins of your diagnosis, how decisions are reached, and how mental disorders are classified?
Patients need to realize, doctors need to realize that the current diagnoses are based on consensus. There's a great deal of interpretation. So I think every consumer should be very well informed. They should be testing the doctor's view with their own experience. Family members should be involved in this. And it's very useful often to get second or third opinions.
For me, knowledge is power. Knowing how it works means you can understand the roots and history of the disorder for which you're being labelled. How you deal with that knowledge is up to you. Labelling the World, the Power of DSM was presented by me, JM. It was produced by Ashley Byrne and is a Made in Manchester production for the BBC World Service.
Everyone's talking about BRIEX, a small Calgary mining company that struck gold half a world away.
They sold a $6 billion gold discovery to the world.
They kept drilling, they kept getting good results.
BRIEX had found the one we all hoped to find.
Investors jumped at the chance to buy up shares.
Everybody was getting in on it.
Suddenly everybody in town was going to be rich.
But there was a problem. You see, the gold, well, it didn't exist.
There's nothing there.
There's no gold. This is a scam.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.